U.S. Senator Charles Schumer of New York describes the impact air traffic delays have had on the U.S. economy in the past year as a $41 billion punch in the gut.
Passengers were delayed by 320 million hours last year. 320 million hours.
A report by the Joint Economic Committee comes a day after American Airlines announced it would start charging passengers $15 for the first checked bag. The airline says it's trying to survive record fuel prices. Nations attending an emergency session on the world food crisis say failure to address the soaring cost of food threatens to undermine gains made in reducing poverty. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
The UN's top human rights official, Louise Arbour, says high prices and food shortages are jeopardizing the well-being and rights of countless people.
In some regions, natural disasters or misguided policies or both compound already severe situations and render them catastrophic for the most discriminated and marginalized populations.
The United Nations estimates more than 850 million people worldwide are going hungry, and another 2 billion are suffering from malnutrition. The World Bank says global food prices have nearly doubled in 3 years. Arbour blames unfair trade practices and skewered policies on subsidies for contributing to the current global food crisis. Other experts say biofuels also play a role. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Gas prices in the U.S. hit a new high overnight. It reached a national average above $3.83 a gallon. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world. On the web at kauffman.org.
News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Summer Studio Theater Company with performances of Tally's Folly, The Turn of the Screw, and The Last 5 Years, beginning on June 13th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Just a reminder, the following is an archived interview being replayed on the Afternoon Magazine today, so although you may hear telephone calls during the program, we can't accept them today. So thank you, and now on to the archived interview.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Tricia Tunstall is a writer and musician. She's also a piano teacher. She says if you took music lessons, chances are very good you remember them. She says, for a six-year-old, a piano lesson can be an act of courage. Every note is an occasion for worry, a tiny drama involving risk and consequence. On the program today, an appreciation of the piano lesson. Tricia Tunstall, the author of Note by Note, A Celebration of the Piano Lesson, is our guest. Tricia Tunstall has taught piano for years in Maplewood, New Jersey. She has served as adjunct professor of music at Drew University and at Bergen College. Currently, she's a doctoral candidate in music education at Boston University. Her fiction has appeared in many publications. She's also written lyrics, and she performs regularly as accompanist for solo artists and musical productions. Her book, Note by Note, A Celebration of the Piano Lesson, is published by Simon & Schuster. Tricia Tunstall, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
We opened with a little Beethoven, a piece that is played at many a recital. You report in your book that you've found over and over again that children love classical music, and they might ask to learn this piece.
That's right. I've had more requests to learn Fur Elise than probably any other piece of music. It's amazing how durable and how beloved that music continues to be. And often I find a child who is not familiar with most classical music and wouldn't be able to identify anything else by Beethoven will still know about that tune, even if not by name. They'll say, I want to learn that thing that goes do 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 do, and I'll know.
Yeah. Well, then where are they exposed to this music?
I think it's pretty ubiquitous in the culture at this point, that particular tune. You do hear it in movies and on ads and on television. And it is, there's no denying, it's catchy. It has a real pull to it, and kids love it. And often kids have heard other kids play it. Mm. They'll go home from school with their friends, and the friends will play it, and they'll say, I like that. I want to learn it.
Yeah, we leave humming it, don't we?
We do. Yeah. That's right. Beethoven had a hit on his hands.
Yeah. At the same time, you say this, listening to music as an activity sufficient unto itself is something very few children have experienced in our visually overstimulated culture. You also say they live with music, they've just never been conscious of hearing it. So when a new student comes to you, how do you begin to talk with them about listening to music?
You know, it's a fascinating thing, and I do speak about that in my book, the fact that I often begin one of the first lessons with a question about what the child listens to. And very frequently, the child's not aware that he or she listens to anything. They'll say, oh, I don't listen to music. And I think it's because they become so used to music as a background environment. There's always music on the car radio or in the store or on the iPod while you're doing your homework. Mm-hmm. Music is everywhere as it never has been before as a background, and yet it's less and less, I think, something that is actually, you know, something to be experienced as with your full attention. And so often children are not conscious that they hear music all the time because they're not really listening to it very hard. So we talk about that. And when they say, I don't listen to music, if I push a little bit and ask, well, what, you know, when you're in the car, what radio station do you listen to? They always have an answer for that. Mm-hmm. Do you have an iPod? They often do. So they become aware that they do, in fact, hear music, even if they don't exactly listen to it.
Do you suggest that they do some listening assignments?
Yeah, I often do in a very informal way.
Yeah.
I tell them that I'd like them to start being aware of what they listen to and to let me know about it. And one of the reasons that I do that is that I think the more I know about a child's listening experiences and what they enjoy listening to, the better I can approach teaching music to them and find a starting point, which is a place where they feel comfortable and enjoy the music. And then we take it from there often. You know, one of my many jobs as a piano teacher, of course, is to expose them to music that they haven't heard and haven't listened to. But I find it very helpful to have a starting point of music that they do listen to, are familiar with, and enjoy.
What do you do with kids who come to you saying, I hate classical music, so that's out? No classical music.
A few of them do.
Yeah.
They certainly do. I say, okay, if that's agreeable to you and your parents, then we'll proceed that way for a while. And the first few lessons, you can do the elementary stages without approaching classical music. In fact, you almost have to. And then when you get to the intermediate stages, you can concentrate on theater music and more popular tunes and children's tunes. Eventually, I mean, I don't let that state of affairs go on indefinitely, and I, sooner or later, with every child, do introduce some classical music and ask them to try it. And they usually are willing to do that and very frequently find out that they like it more than they thought.
Yeah. Well, tell us about two boys, Christopher and Max. They were quite enamored of Beethoven's Fifth. What did they tell you about why they were drawn to that?
They actually didn't have words for why they were drawn. They just knew they loved it. And they were, um, as I as I mentioned in my book, at different skill levels. Christopher was a less experienced student than Max was. And so Christopher, we did what we did with both. What I did with both of them was put together a version by ear, which was for each of them at a level that they could manage. We listened. We sat in the lesson and spent a little time listening. I asked them to listen to it at home, and we listened to it a little bit at a time in the lesson. Then we worked out a way for them to play it, as I said, the skill level that they were comfortable with, and they absolutely loved it. I don't think they ever articulated, you know, I love this music because it's in a minor key and it's very dramatic and it's very powerful. I don't think they knew that in those words, but they certainly felt it and responded to it.
Why do you think they're drawn to it?
It's such an exciting piece of music. They're drawn to it for the same reasons, you know, millions of people have been drawn to it across the world since it was written. It's the opening in the minor key is dramatic. It's very propulsive. It has that short, totally recognizable, insistent little theme, and which drives the music in a very sort of energetic and exciting way. It arouses all kinds of exciting, I think, feelings, and it's a stirring piece of music, and kids feel that.
Yeah. Now, once kids are exposed to music like this and they find it exciting and they really like it, do they put it on their iPods?
We hope. We certainly hope so. I have had that happen. I've had children who play simplified arrangements of, for example, Dvorak's New World Symphony theme. When they play it and then I play it for them, my recording of it for them, I've had several of them say, I love that, I have to download that. What else has that happened with? That happens with Beethoven sometimes. That's happened with Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite. So, yes, sometimes they do actually go out into the world and decide that music belongs on their iPod as well, and they want to listen to that.
Yeah. Well, 15-year-old Max was passionate about jazz, and so he was carrying around Oscar Peterson,
yes,
which I find pretty incredible.
I did, too. I did too. Max's parents are avid music lovers and exposed him to all kinds of good music as a child, classical and jazz. And Max was one of the students that, at the age of 15 or so, decided he would not play classical music any longer, but he did love jazz and particularly Oscar Peterson. And I was surprised to find that on his iPod, but delighted too. And we listened to a few of his solos and very painstakingly picked out a few of them, which is the way that from many, many years, children, young people have learned to play jazz, is by listening to the solos and copying them.
Yeah. It seems to me in this anecdote, in that part of the book, that it seems that one of the rewards of teaching is learning, because you had to figure out how to break it down for him.
Absolutely.
And then he said to you, well, now you have to teach me how to improvise.
Right. Yes, he did. And as I recount in the book, I told him that I wasn't sure I could go very far with him in that regard because I'm not primarily an improviser myself. Very hard to teach, pretty impossible to teach something that you really don't know yourself. My experiences trying to learn to improvise were fairly short-lived, and while I have limited experience with it and knowledge about it, I could only take him so far with that. I have taken him a little bit in that direction, and he still continues to play Oscar Peterson and to try venturing into improvising a bit. But improvising, real masterful jazz improvising, is such a complicated and wonderful art form that I wouldn't attempt to try to teach a kid who was really serious about learning it. I would have to send him to someone who really was a master of that.
Yeah. When it comes to that point in the relationship, how do you make that transition or help the student make that transition to another teacher?
I've only done that a few times and always recommended teachers. You know, I have friends in the area who are wonderful jazz players and teach jazz specifically, and so the few times that I've done that, I've only recommended teachers that I knew were wonderful both people and teachers. And I usually have not broken ties with the student. Very frequently that happens with the student continuing to come to me, starting with the other teacher, and then sort of gradually phasing out and phasing over so that it's not an abrupt break.
Yeah, yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Tricia Tunstall. She's a writer. She's a musician. She's also a piano teacher, and she is the author of Note by Note, a celebration of the piano lesson. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories from your past. Maybe you've got a story about a music teacher or music lessons that you would like to tell us about. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. How often are you surprised when a child says to you there's something in particular they want to play and then your jaw just drops?
That does happen. That happens with some regularity, particularly students who are newer to me. And they'll come to me often with their iPods, and they'll say, I have this tune I really want to learn. It's great. You'll love it. And we plug in their iPods and listen. And sometimes, not often, but sometimes, it's a very sort of heavy metal piece of rock music, which there's absolutely no way to approximate on the piano, or it's a hard-driving hip-hop tune with no melody, very little harmony, and, you know, mostly a very insistent beat and spoken words. And at that point, I'll have to point out to them that there really is not much here that a piano can render, you know? And they're not aware of that until I point that out. They've been so caught up in the rhythm of it and the words of it and sort of bopping their head to it that it hasn't occurred to them that, this is made of words and a beat, but there's really not much here that you can do on piano keys.
I wonder if, I guess hopefully you would say that this is something you hope for, that once a person begins piano lessons, a child begins piano lessons, that they begin to listen and they begin to maybe gain some insights into the music that they have on their iPod, insights into pop music. Do you see that happening?
I do see that happening a lot. And the more a student is with me, particularly a student who's been engaged in learning pop music as well as classical music with me in the lessons, the longer that goes on, the more sure sense they have of what music, which of their favorite pop tunes on their iPods are going to make a good piano piece and which ones are simply not going to work. They do really get pretty sophisticated about that. They learn about the elements of music as we dissect a pop tune and put it together again as a piano piece. They can't help but learn about the elements of music. They learn that there's a melody happening, and often that melody repeats when the chorus comes along again. And they learn that there are harmonies that we usually render by playing chords. They learn that there is a meter to it. It's a wonderful way of introducing the elements of music, I think, by teaching pop tunes by ear.
Yeah. Are there parents who wonder if that's what their child should be doing in a piano lesson?
Well, certainly, and I want to make it clear that that's not all I do in piano.
Sure.
I certainly pay attention to the technical progress of the children and also to playing classical music as well. Almost all of my students come to me and learn to play a mix of classical and popular music. Some of them only want to concentrate on classical music. Some are very insistent that they only want to concentrate on popular music. When that happens, I do check with the parents. When a child says to me, I just don't want to do classical anymore, I only want to do pop music, I always check with the parents and say, how do you feel about this? And I would say that most of the time a parent's reaction is, I'm happy that he or she is playing. I want her or he. I want them to keep playing. And if that's what they want to play, that's fine. I find that most of the time parents are very interested in their children
being engaged at the piano, mm-hmm. much more that than in specifically what they're playing.
Yeah. Well, if it's something that gets them to the piano to practice,
mm-hmm.
you know.
That's right. And it often does.
Yeah. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Here's a story for you. When I was a kid, I took piano lessons, and I absolutely loathed it. And I wouldn't practice, and finally the piano teacher told my mother, he said, you know, you're just wasting your money on this kid, and I'm wasting my time, so I'm going to just call it quits. So I stopped taking piano lessons, and within a week, I was at the piano, and I worked my way up through the two-part inventions.
That's a great story.
And I, to this day, I have no idea why. Although I think part of it was the kinds of drills he had me going through were extremely repetitive.
Yeah.
And with the two-part inventions, I would pick my way through note by note.
Uh-huh.
And I memorized it as I went.
Right.
So that, and I still can't sight read very well.
Right, but if you could read those two-part inventions, that was great, and you were learning new music all the time. You weren't just repeating.
That's right, and I did get onto the well-tempered clavichord too. So
that's great. I think you did just fine.
Yeah, and I really enjoy it too.
Do you still play?
Oh yeah.
That's great.
And I did learn for Elise too.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
Thanks for the program.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Other telephone calls are invited this afternoon for our guest, Tricia Tunstall, author of Note by Note, a celebration of the piano lesson. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hi, I'm glad I happen to be in my car right now.
Yes.
I'm a grandparent who has a granddaughter in third grade, and they don't have a very big home, and a piano would really impose on their life space. And I wondered, is third grade a good time to start playing, and can they use an electronic piano to practice on and things like something
yes.
like that?
Yes, they can. First of all, third grade is a fine time to begin. I think that's a very, very good time to begin because the child already knows how to read words, so her reading facility is sort of in place, and so it's much easier to learn to read music once a child knows how to read words. So I think it's a great time. And as for the piano, it's very possible to start on an electric keyboard, and a lot of my students do that. When the student progresses for several years, and if the student is still interested several years down the road, most parents find it a good idea to, at that point, move to a real piano.
Very good. Well, she has access to a real piano at her other grandparents' home. So she
okay, well, that's a good thing, too. But mm-hmm. I would absolutely, if she's interested, I would say get an electric keyboard and get her started, for
Could
sure.
Could you give me just a real quick advice about what level of keyboard?
I can't talk about brands or anything like that, but I can tell you that you really need something pretty simple. You don't need a lot of bells and whistles because the bells and whistles actually distract from the process of learning to, you know, becoming comfortable with the keys and learning to play. You don't want her experimenting with 5,000, you know, bird call sounds and all of that stuff. If it has a good piano sound, if it has at least 4 octaves, she's going to be fine with it for a little while.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What kind of advice can you share with us about finding a good teacher?
You know, my mother is the one I credit with knowing how to do that brilliantly, because when I was growing up, my family moved around a great deal, And my mother managed to find wonderful teachers everywhere we went. And as a result, I have such fabulous memories of a lot of piano teachers whom I speak about quite a bit in the book, talking about my recollections of each one of them, how wonderful each one was and how very individual each one was, how I got something very different from each one. In terms of advice, I think what my mother did is what I would advise, which is, word of mouth in a community is a wonderful thing. Find out who other people study with and who other people like studying with, and then try it. And if your child has a good initial reaction to a piano teacher, that's a really good indication that that's going to be a good teacher for that child, because it's so the relationship between teacher and student is so important to the success of that endeavor.
Mm. Tell us about Madame Dmitrieff.
Madame Dmitrieff was a very vivid personality indeed. I studied with her for several years in my early adolescence when we lived in Washington, and she had a studio apartment on DuPont Circle, I believe, a piano studio. She had grown up, spent her early years in Russia as the daughter of a palace guard for the last czar, and she had actually studied. She was a prodigious young pianist in those last days of the Russian Empire. She studied with Rachmaninoff, and then her family had to flee when the revolution came along, and they fled first to Europe and then London, and then eventually came to rest in the United States. And she had a performing and a teaching career that was very long and very productive. There are still lots of piano teachers in the country, I'm sure, who experienced her teaching and who remember her.
Yeah. At the time, did you have an appreciation for the amazingness of her life?
I didn't really know some of the details about her life until later on when I spoke with other former students of hers. At the time, I knew she had been from Russia. I knew that during the revolution she had to leave. I knew that she had had an illustrious career there. And I knew that I kind of sensed that she had had an eventful and turbulent life. How I sensed it, I'm not sure, because she didn't talk a lot about it to me at that time. I was 12 or 13, and so she wasn't confiding in me. We were talking about music. But I definitely sensed from her that she had had a very interesting and turbulent life. And the way she spoke about the music that we were working on really let me know that she was a passionate person.
Yeah, that's what comes through the way you write about her in Note by Note.
Lots
her passion,
lots of energy, and very strong opinions.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Charleston, line 4. Hello? Line 4, that's you. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Joanne, and I'm currently calling from Charleston, but I'm a new piano teacher based in Los Angeles, actually, in California, and I just tuned into your program. And I just have a very specific question for you regarding approaching students that you were talking about, approaching students that are not necessarily interested in playing strictly classical methods.
Right.
And, playing from, I usually teach from the Hal Leonard method, and that's what I learned within my pedagogy program at Northwestern, which is where I went.
Uh-huh.
And I was curious as to whether or not you had any suggestions for improvisation method books or jazz method books that someone who is not necessarily as trained in that area could use with younger students to kind of spark an interest in just, you know, being at the piano and just being, just practicing at least just for the fun of it.
Right.
Not necessarily worried about whether or not they're getting their daily practice limit in, you know.
Right. I don't have specific suggestions about method books. Because that part of my teaching, I tend to do more, I rely more on listening to music and then trying to reproduce it by ear than I do on using books of methodology. I'm sure there are good ones out there, and I would be delighted to find recommendations, too. But I take that part of my teaching, I use as an opportunity to encourage children to listen and then play without it going through the mediation of something on a page. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, right. So you would have them maybe pick a song or something that they were interested in and try to reproduce it themselves, or do it during the lesson with me?
We do it, right. We do it some, we start it during the lesson, we listen to it, we talk about sort of what it's made of and how it's put together. We find, I help them pick out the melody to it. They get much better at that as we, the more they do it, and it's amazing to see how practice really helps them do that. And then we start talking about the harmonies and the rhythms, and I help them figure out ways to reproduce those on the piano. And again, the more experienced they are and the more they do it here with me at the lesson, the more they eventually can do it themselves at home, and often do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I can see how that could work with a wide range of levels, too.
Yes, it really does. It can work on a very simple level or on a more sophisticated level.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Welcome. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's take another call, a listener in Urbana. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
My mother is a pianist and organist, and so is my grandmother, who's no longer with us. And my mother was taught by her mother, and then it was my turn.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful, but it was brief. Because my grandmother has a strong personality and flamboyant, passionate, and all those great things that an artist should have.
Right.
And I'm an artist, a visual artist mostly, and into music too, singing and percussion. But I took lessons with her, and it was brief. And I instead cleaned her house and got to listen to her play in the background. And sometimes I was a kid, you know, young teenager and a little younger, and I would be vacuuming, and then I'd turn the corner. This is just a little story.
Yeah.
And I turned the corner, and she's playing. She's getting distracted by her daily kind of routine of getting dressed, and so all she has on are her pantyhose and her eye.
Oh,
we lost that beautiful story.
I hope she will call back.
I hope so too.
Yeah,
that's a vivid picture of her.
Yeah, it sounds like the grandmother really loved her music and
yes.
was always there.
Yeah, and couldn't wait to get all the way dressed.
Yeah,
before getting to it.
I hope that caller will call back. Right. Let's take another call in the meantime. Another listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
This will be a quick one, but I just wanted to mention when you were talking about different things from what's necessarily in the book or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When I was taking piano lessons as a child, I got a little tired of John Thompson.
Right.
And I was in the local church choir, and I asked if I could do some hymns for a change.
Uh-huh.
And my teacher was very supportive of that idea and said, if that's what you'd like to do, by all means. And so I got kind of a second wind with the hymns.
That's wonderful.
And I liked the chords, and I have some favorites still.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you still play?
Not now, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
But, hymns
are very appealing. They're like popular music in that they have simple, strong melodies and recognizable chords, and,
yes.
and they're familiar. So that's a wonderful place to go.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.
Wonderful.
And I also happened to meet Rachmaninoff on Long Island.
You did?
Yes.
Did you hear him play?
No, unfortunately. I was taking a ballet lesson in some Russian emigre home,
uh-huh.
and he happened to be visiting that day and came down and scared the piano gal, who was the mother of one of us, out of her wits.
I bet. I'm not sure I'd want to play in front of Rachmaninoff either.
Well, she'd stopped, and he went around and shook everybody's hand, but I hid behind my sister because I thought I didn't know who he was. She was older than I, so I didn't get to shake his hand.
It's a great memory to have, though. A
wonderful memory, yes. Thank you so much for the program, Celeste, and our guest.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You.
Thanks for calling in this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon, Tricia Tunstall. She's a writer and a musician. She's also a piano teacher, and she's the author of Note by Note, a celebration of the piano lesson. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, share your stories of music lessons with us this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we hope the listener from Urbana who somehow we lost will join us again and tell us the ending of her story about her grandmother. Tricia Tunstall's book, Note by Note, published by Simon and Schuster. There are all kinds of ways today to learn to play a musical instrument, DVDs, online lessons. Is the one-on-one method of instruction endangered?
You know, I don't worry about it at all. It's interesting that even as these online methods and these do-it-yourself packages proliferate, my phone rings very steadily with new requests for piano lessons, and all the other piano teachers I know have the same experience, that there are lots and lots of people who definitely want the good old-fashioned piano lesson. They don't want to learn it on a CD. They don't want to watch it on a DVD. They want to learn it through the relationship. So I'm very, as my subtitle indicates, a celebration of the piano lesson. This is something that I find very heartening, that the piano lesson is such a sturdy, enduring ritual.
Why? What is the appeal of the music lesson?
Exploring that question is one of the reasons that I started to write the book, as I was so struck by it and thought it was something really to explore. And I think I don't have a definitive answer, but I would say that the relationship between teacher and student, first of all, is a very specific and unique one. It's not easy to learn to play a musical instrument. And the process of learning to do it involves a lot of patience and discipline and tolerance and affection. All of those things you can really experience together in the one-on-one context of the piano teacher-student relationship. And I think that the specialness of that relationship is something that people really value and appreciate. Mm. So that's one thing that keeps it alive. And I think also that the idea that it's a good thing to play a musical instrument, that it's good for you, good for the culture and good for the individual, an important part of being an educated person is knowing something about playing a musical instrument. I think that idea is still stronger than we might expect.
And is that why parents want music lessons for their children?
Yeah. Parents come with a variety of reasons, and often it's simply at the kids' urging. But I think many parents that have come to me with their children for lessons do have that sense that it's an important part of learning. It's an important part of an emotional education, of an artistic education, to learn to play a musical instrument and learn expressiveness in that way. And I've had very few parents approach me with the thought that their child would be a professional musician. Most, if not all, approach with the idea that they want it to be part of the child's education.
Hmm. And parents who want music lessons for their children, did they have music lessons as children?
You know, often they say they wished they had.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons they are so interested in their child having it.
Yeah. Boy, I wish I had.
You too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so interesting. I find that that adults whom I meet and tell them what I do usually have one of two responses. One response is, I wish I had had piano lessons. Or the other response that's so frequent is, oh, my gosh, I remember my piano teacher. And then I'll hear some very specific sort of tactile remembrance of the piano teacher, whether it's about her dog or about, you know, the way the room looked or about her perfume. Something is something's very strong and specific and sensory about that memory.
Yeah, and I suppose that gets us back to the connection, the one-on-one relationship.
Yes, the connection is very important and very different from the connections that most children have. Most of their instruction these days comes in a group setting, and usually when they're with it's not that frequent that they're learning something on an individual basis with the same teacher day in and day out. Just an experience of learning and teaching between two people.
Yeah. I did take skating lessons, and I loved them. I wasn't very good at it, but also there was where I began to have a better appreciation for music because we skated.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, that's something more than, in that kind of setting, that music is more than just the background. Music is really is the backbone of what you're doing.
Yeah.
You do have to attend to it.
Yeah. Dancing, I think, also.
Well, dancing and skating is a lot like dancing, and dancing is very much about that.
Yeah. And those are, well, dancing certainly is an activity we can come to at any stage in life. What about beginning piano lessons as an adult?
I've had a number of adult piano students, and they've come for all sorts of reasons, but it's very different teaching adults, I've found, than from teaching kids. Adults come with much more of an agenda. A child comes saying, you know, show me something. I want to do something. Show me how to do something on this instrument. Adults often come with, I want to learn. For example, one friend of mine said, I'd like to come take lessons from you because I want to learn to play Clair de Lune by Debussy. Hmm. I said, well, would you like to learn anything in between here and there? And she said, no, I really just want to learn to play that piece. Well, and she had never played piano before. I got a simplified version of that piece, and by golly, she did, after a year, learn to play Clair de Lune, and then she stopped. That was it. Not all grown-ups come with that specific an agenda, of course, but they do come with more of an agenda, and they come expecting more of themselves than children do. They're more critical of themselves than children are. Sometimes teaching an adult to play the piano is really an exercise in helping them to be patient with themselves and forgive their mistakes.
Mm.
They're not inclined to do that.
Mm. So there's a lot of things going on in a piano lesson and over the course of learning how to play an instrument.
I think many things. You're learning music, but you're also learning. You're learning how to learn. You're learning self-discipline. You're learning about yourself, definitely.
Mm. What's the state of music education kindergarten through high school?
I wish I knew more about that, but my impression is that music education kindergarten through high school is in some trouble, in this country at least. Certainly I know that in my area, the state of New Jersey, that there have been budget cuts in the arts throughout public schools, and that has meant hard times for music education in the public school system. I've seen it right here in my own town. It's been very disconcerting and depressing to watch the school music lessons, the instrumental music lessons, which used to start in third grade, then they were taken away from third grade, then they started in fourth grade, and now they start in fifth grade. That's a very depressing thing to watch. And my impression is that in many areas of the country, when school budgets shrink, it's the arts and music that go first. And that's something that I know musicians and educators are very, very concerned about, and lots of advocacy is going on in that area to try to prevent that trend from accelerating.
Yeah. Are we shortchanging these students?
I think absolutely. I think that music education is such a vital part of education in general. And, there was a spate of studies done in the 1990s about how if you were learning to play a musical instrument, the other academic subjects you were studying often improved. It's not clear that there's a direct connection like that there, but I think that there is a more general sort of, there are many things that one learns from studying a musical instrument about structure, about organization, about self-discipline, and I think most important is the expressive and emotional aspect of that. When you learn to play a musical instrument, you learn, it's part of one's emotional education that I think just can't, we lose that really to our detriment.
Yeah. There were a number of anecdotes about your students where they learned to play a piece, I suspect, in order to please a parent.
Yes.
A little boy who learned to play The Long and Winding Road.
Yes.
He said, the Beatles are so over. But.
You know, the Beatles are not over for my students.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Just amazing to me how much so many of them love the Beatles. And I'm teaching Beatles songs every week. I teach Beatles songs in at least, you know, three or four lessons. Those songs are so beautifully put together and immediately appealing that they've been rediscovered by a whole new generation.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a seven-year-old in the book who comes to a lesson, her first lesson. I don't think she was a student for a very long time, but anyway, she came to you and she said she wanted to learn. She came with her grandmother, who was an artist.
Oh, right.
And she said, I want to learn how to play Folsom Prison Blues.
She did. Yes, she did. And you're right, that certainly had something to do with the music that her parents listened to.
Yeah, yeah.
And by golly, she learned to play it. She didn't go on to become one of my most advanced students, but she was very satisfied with Folsom Prison Blues.
Yeah, yeah. It would be wonderful to sit down and be able to play something. And I think, you know, I'm surprised the woman who wanted to learn to play Clair de Lune stopped then, because I think once you mastered a piece, you'd say, well, what else can I do?
You know, and many people say that,
yeah.
Too. Yes. Yeah. It is that they do really get inspired by the... just the thrill of being able to sit down and play something. Mm. And then they want to learn to do it again with something else.
Mm. We have to wrap up now. It's been a great pleasure talking with you this afternoon. Thanks so much for spending some time with us this
afternoon.
Well,
thank you. It's been a pleasure for me to be speaking with you and your listeners. I've enjoyed it very much.
Tricia Tunstall has been our guest in this portion of the program. She's a writer and musician. She's also a piano teacher, and she's the author of Note by Note, A Celebration of the Piano Lesson. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.
And that was a rebroadcast of an Afternoon Magazine interview, first aired in April of this year, the week of April the 14th. I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for Celeste Quinn today. It's 151. The highs, lows, and settlements are in from the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. And first, from the grain pits, here are the numbers from Todd Gleason. Todd.
Thank you very much, Jay. This is the way the numbers settled from the CME Group's Chicago Board of Trade side today. July futures in the wheat pit, 33 cents lower today. $7.88 the high, the low at $7.42. A settlement price at $7.45. July wheat, soft red, down 33 today. September futures, 8.01¾ the high in Chicago, the low at 59.5. A settlement price at $7.60¼, down 32¾. In December futures, 8.23½ the high, the low at 7.80. Settlement price at 7.82, down 32. The March futures down 31.5. The high at 8.38. The low at 7.99¼. Settlement price for the March wheat at 8.01, 31.5 cents lower. July 09 contract settled down 27 cents at $8.17. Kansas July wheat down 29¾ for the hard red at $8.25. July corn futures from Chicago, an 11.5 cent loss today, $6.11¼ the high, the low at 5.95, settlement price at 5.95¾, 11.5 lower. September 6.23½ the high, the low at 6.07½, a settlement price at 6.08½ down 11¼. In December futures, 6.37½ the high, the low at 22, settlement price at $6.23¼, 10¼ cents lower. The March futures down a dime today, $6.50 the high, the low down to $6.35, settled just above that, $6.35¾, settled just above that at $6.36¼, 10 cents lower for the March corn futures. May contract, 6.53½ the high, the low at 44¾, settlement price at $6.44, down 9½ cents in the May future, 6.53½ the high, the low at 6 in the May, 44¾, and a settlement price at 6.44, 9½ cents lower. Soy complex now, July beans, $13.67¼, the high, the low at $13.12½, Settlement price at 13.24¾, 24¼ cents higher. August futures 13.70, the high, the low at 13.16. Settlement price at $13.28¼, down 24¼. That for the August soybeans for the day. And the September futures 13.66¼, the high, the low at 13.14½. A settlement price at $13.24¼, down 28¼ cents. November soybeans, a high today at $13.70¾. The low ranging down to $13.15, settled just about a dime above that at $13.24¼. It was an outside trading range, is that right? Yes, it was, in the bean pit today. And they finished in the November contract down 30¾ cents. January futures, 13.80, the high, the low at 13.29½. Settlement price at 13.37¾, down 30¾. And November beans, 13.30¾ cents. This is for the 2009 contract, down 21¼. The high there at 13.77½. The low at $13.20¼ for the day. July bean meal futures down $4.50. The high at 337.50. That's 337.50. The low at 325. Settlement price down $4.50 at $328 for the July bean meal. August contract at 339.50. Top bottom at 327.30. And a settlement price at 330.30, down 420. July bean oil futures 63.70. The high, the low at 60.80. Settled at 61.83, down 142. August futures were down 143. They settled at 62.15. The top at $64 even, and the bottom at 61.17. I'll return in 11 minutes when we'll talk this afternoon during the closing market report with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. And the folks at the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana will join us to take a look at the cash grain market. Stay with us for the closing market report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And let's take a look at now how the prices went on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for live cattle for June. The high today was 95.20. The low is 94. Even the settlement, 95.15. Up 52½. August had a high of 100 even and a low of 98.90. The settlement was 99.85, up 30. May feeder cattle had a high of 108, a low of 107.85. Settlement was 107.87½, down 17½. August, 114.95 was the high, 113.60 was the low, 114.75 was the settlement, and that was up 37½. September, 115.65 for the high, the low was 114.35, the settlement 115.32½, up 22½. And October feeder cattle had a high of 116.20, a low of 114.70, the settlement was 116.15, up 30. June lean hogs had a high of 77.05, a low of 76.20. The settlement was 76.92½, up 42½. July had a high of 76.35, a low of 75.80. Settlement 76.27½, up 15. August lean hogs had a high of 77.30, a low of 76.65. The settlement was 77.20, down 5. October lean hogs had a high of 73.97½, a low of 73.35. The settlement 73.85, up 17½. And the frozen pork bellies for July had a high of 74.15, a low of 74. Make that a high of 75.27½, a low of 74.15, and the settlement was 74.85, and that was down 55. Well, a look at the two-state forecast for Illinois and Indiana by Mike Sola. For the remainder of this afternoon in west central and southern Illinois and in southwest Indiana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and some isolated thunderstorms. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny and highs ranging from around 60 near Lake Michigan to 74 degrees in the far south. And for tonight, we're looking in northeastern Illinois and northern Indiana and central Indiana for partly to mostly cloudy skies. Elsewhere, cloudy with scattered showers and a few thunderstorms, and lows from 42 in northeast Indiana to 58 in southwestern Illinois. Tomorrow in the south, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered thunderstorms. Elsewhere, cloudy with occasional showers and a few thunderstorms and highs ranging from near 60 around Lake Michigan to 82 in far southern Illinois. For Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy, showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms, high 71. Mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of a few showers and a low of 48, and then mostly cloudy with some showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, 67 for the high. Mostly sunny, warmer on Saturday, 77, sunny and warm Sunday, 82, and then we'll have another chance of rain on Monday, Memorial Day. Right now on Friends Plaza outside of Campbell Hall for public telecommunication here in Urbana, it's 70 degrees, and it's coming up on a minute before 2 o'clock. At a minute past 2, we will have NPR News and then the closing market report. And then at 3 this afternoon on PRI's The World, take a trip to Brazil's rainforest, actually above the rainforest. Climate scientists are monitoring vital signs there to gauge the health of the Amazon rainforest. That story and the day's news coming up on The World at 3 o'clock this afternoon and then again at 7 o'clock this evening here on AM 580. WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.